We've been singing this morning about a great anticipation, a longing, a yearning in our hearts for God to come and restore the world we live in, the people that we know, ourselves. I hope you've seen this thread through the story of Israel. I mean, that's what we've been building up to, that over the last number of weeks, it's been over a month now actually, that we've been unpacking the story of Israel as we unpack the grand story of the Bible. And it's a story about longing, a longing for wholeness and restoration. And it's the story about a good God who relentlessly pursues his people. And this morning we come to the beginning of the last chapter in the story of the nation of Israel. And we pick that story up where we left off last week. Solomon was the king, and he was the son of King David. And it was under Solomon's rule that the nation of Israel reached the pinnacle of its success. And the success of Israel was symbolized by a city, the city of Jerusalem. You see, the city of Jerusalem, it came to represent the culmination of all of God's promises to Israel. It came to represent the culmination of his covenant promises to the people of God. You see, the nation of Israel, the city of Jerusalem was a great city. It was a city that bared the name of God in some respect. It was a city that was a great nation, and it lived under the blessing of God, and it was a great city on a hill that was a light, a beacon to all the nations around it. And that was the very promise that God gave to Abraham, to make him into a mighty nation, to bless him, and that through him he would be a blessing. Through his line, his family, they would be a blessing to the world. And so Jerusalem, it emerges as a symbol of God's covenant promise to the nation of Israel. And that covenant promise, it was embodied by four particular things. For someone who would call themselves an Israelite in those days, to be a person of God's promise was to possess four particular things. First, to be a person of God's promise was to mean that they had the law. Secondly, it meant that they had a king. Thirdly, they had the land. And fourthly, the temple. And let me run through each of these. That in the mind of an Israelite in these days, living under King Solomon, that they saw themselves as people of God's promise because first and foremost, they had the law. And the law, it formed a common identity for the people of Israel. And if you remember, as I taught about the law is not simply a list of rules of do's and don'ts, but rather it's a way of life. That God intended for his people to be a reflection of him in the world, to bear his image in the world. And so he gives them the law and says, I will be your God and you will be my people. And this is what it looks like. And so the nation of Israel, they had the law and it formed their common identity as the people of God. But secondly, they had a king. And as we learned last week, the king became the focus of Israel's hope. That the king was this human agent that would come and it would lead God's people into the forever kingdom, would establish a kingdom that would live on forever and ever. And that this human king would lead them into life the way it was meant to be. And thirdly, to be marked with God's promise was to have the land that God promised them. And the promised land was a means of God's provision to his people. This was the way in which God would bring a rich and abundant provision. He would bring his resources and wealth and prosperity through the land that he had promised them. And fourthly, people of the promise were marked by the temple. And we read about this in 1 Kings chapter 8. That when Solomon, he builds this grand temple unto the Lord, and as he dedicates it at the end of 1 Kings chapter 8, the glory of God comes to rest and dwell in that temple in a way like no other. Well, it harkened back to the tabernacle when the Israelites were wandering around in the desert where God, his presence, came to dwell among his people. It was believed that the temple is where heaven met earth. This was God living on earth among his people in a way that we don't understand, in a way that we can't explain. But these four things marked Israel as people of the promise. They had the law. They lived as his people. They had a king, the one who was going to lead them into all that they had ever hoped for. They had the promised land. It was rich and abundant, and they had the very presence of God living in their midst. And it was under King Solomon's rule that these four markers of the promised people, they came into effect. They all seemed to come together under the reign of King Solomon. Israel had arrived. Glory. They lived as this great pinnacle of God's glory in the world. Life was just the way it was meant to be. Rich and abundant and flourishing, a picture of God's glory. But their fall from glory was spectacular, wasn't it? I'm a soccer fan. And Manchester United is my favorite soccer team. I hope I don't make any enemies saying that. I know soccer's not a huge thing here in Canada. Well, I've made a couple over here with Andy. Are you a United fan, Andy? Okay, I'm sorry. We can talk later. Andy's British, so he knows what I'm talking about when I say football. It's not soccer, it's football. And Manchester United is the team that I support. I've been following them for years. And Manchester United is arguably, all right, Andy, you get this, arguably one of the best football teams on the face of the earth, at least historically. Under the leadership and management of a man named Sir Alex Ferguson, Manchester United raised to dominance in the football world. They won title after title. They were the team to beat in soccer. And there was this song that they would sing in the stadium when they were at Old Trafford. They would sing this song. Glory, glory, Man United. Glory, glory, Man United. And it would go on. And actually, some of the words aren't worth saying in church. And it was this song that spoke of their glory, their dominance, that they were the team to beat. But it was in 2013 when Sir Alex Ferguson, he retired as a manager, and their fall from glory has been spectacular. That these days, when they step onto the pitch, before when they'd step onto the pitch, you knew they were going to win. Now, well, it's anyone's game. And when they sing the song, glory, glory, Man United. It doesn't sing into reality. It harkens back to a time in the past. In fact, the song, perhaps for many fans, it brings up much pain, not joy. This was a picture of Israel. That once they lived under the glory of God. But now in these days, as we move into what we call the exile, another slice of Israel's history, they're not marked with glory. You see, Solomon, he led them into glory. They possessed all four of these things, but we see that Solomon's leadership was a failure. He said no to God. He rejected his ways. He served other gods. And that at the end of his leadership, we see this whole thing become unraveled. That there's a fight for leadership in Israel at the end of Solomon's reign. And there, what we once knew as the United Kingdom of Israel, it splits and fragments into two pieces at the end of Solomon's reign. Here we see what we might call the first church split. That there's a fight for battle. The kingdom becomes divided. And so there's a king in the north, which governs what we call the kingdom of Israel at this time. And then there was a king in the south who governed the kingdom of Judah. And in the north, in the kingdom of Israel, there were 12 of the tribes of Abraham. Or sorry, there were 10 of the tribes. And then in the south, in Judah, there were 2 of the tribes. The kingdom had become divided. No longer under one king, now under 2 separate kings. And as we trace the story of these individual kings in this divided kingdom, we see that they continue to spiral Israel into further rebellion and sin. Though there are some good kings that come, it's as though Israel can't get out of this hopeless cycle that we've seen for the past couple of weeks now. And so Israel divides. We have the kingdom of Israel in the north and the kingdom of Judah in the south. And so God sends his prophets. He sends prophets to warn the people of Israel, saying, return to the Lord. Come back. Turn your hearts back. Because if you don't, disaster is happening. And this is how we understand all the books of the prophets, that they're God's messengers who come to call Israel back, the people of God back, to turn their hearts, to repent, to come back to what they were made for in the first place. But we know the story. Israel just can't seem to get it right. Their hearts rebel, and disaster ensues. It happened first for the nation of Israel up north. The Assyrians came with their armies. And the Assyrians were a brutal people. That they came and they killed and they massacred the northern kingdom of Israel. And they took the remaining survivors and they bound them in chains and they marched them out of the land. The nation of Judah did a little bit better. They fared for another 200 years. They are living in this cycle of hopelessness, of rebellion. And for them, it came through the armies of Babylon. The Babylonians marched into the city of Jerusalem, the centerpiece, the symbol of God's promises. And there a war ensued for almost a year, and the casualties were many. And there in the final bits of the battle, the Babylonians entered into the city of Jerusalem, and they massacred anyone they could find. And they ran into the temple, and they knocked over all of the sacred elements, and they set it on fire and turned over bricks. The temple destroyed. And they took the remaining survivors, and they put them in chains, and they marched them to Babylon. You see, the fall from glory for the people of God, it was spectacular. That once living under the glory of God, marked by the promises of God, the law, a king, the land, and the temple, now all four were destroyed. Israel was in exile. And sometimes life doesn't turn out the way we want it to, does it? And that certainly was true for Israel. That they live with the sense that we are the chosen people of God, that we are to be blessed, that we are to be a blessing, that we live in the glory of God. But here now they find themselves so far from that promise, living in exile. Hope is gone. Have you ever lived in a place like that, where you feel so cut off from the goodness of God, where life is dark, you feel like you're in a pit? And when we're in a place like this, I'm convinced that there are questions that arise in our mind. We have time to think. We have time to analyze. And there are three particular questions that often come up when we live in a place like the exile. First, where are you, God? Where are you in all of this? Secondly, we ask, how did this happen? How could all of this happen to me? And thirdly, how will you fix it, God? How will this broken situation be made right again? Maybe you've asked these kinds of questions in your own life. Well, for the nation of Israel, they had answers to the first two questions. The first question, God, where are you? If anything we have learned in this story through this journey through the story of Israel is that God is on a relentless pursuit to restore his broken people. He does not stop. And so when they ask the question, where are you, God? The answer comes ringing true. He's right there, waiting to restore, waiting to renew. And when they ask the question, how did this happen, God? Well, the answer's obvious. It happened because you rejected God's ways. It happened because you said no to his leadership. And whenever we say no to God and his leadership in our life, the world unravels. Darkness ensues. Chaos erupts. Brokenness marks us. And so they had answers to the first two questions, but the important question, the question that the exile brings into focus for us today, is the last one. How will all of this be fixed, God? And you see, this is where Israel's story, it intersects with our own story. You see, there are times when we look at our life and we see this isn't the way it's meant to be. This isn't how life is supposed to be. If you remember back at the beginning of our series in Genesis chapter 1 and 2, we looked at how things were meant to be. Humanity created in the good image of God, made for goodness, that we were made to flourish in four fundamental relationships, that we were made to flourish in our relationship with God, with ourselves, with other people, and with the earth that God had entrusted to us. This is what life's supposed to look like. Flourishing. But when we turn on the news, or when we read the newspaper, we don't read about relationships that are flourishing. We read about a world that's broken. We read about people who go starving. We read about governments who are corrupt. We read about murder and rape. This can't be what God had in mind. It's not what God had in mind. But we don't just see it in the newspaper, that if we're honest, if we look in our own families, if we look in our own hearts, we see that there's something wrong. Greed, jealousy, anger, a desire to get ahead at the expense of others, selfishness. See, when we take an honest look at our world and our life, we see things aren't the way they're meant to be. That in many respects, we find ourselves in exile. That we've been made for the glory of God, but we find ourselves in exile. And in places like this, we ask three questions. Where are you, God? Well, the answer comes back the same as it did to Israel, that God is on a relentless pursuit to restore you and I. He's right there. How did this happen? And this is a piece that the people don't like to hear, but it's the truth. It happened because we've rejected God and his ways in our life. That the world isn't what it's meant to be because of sin, our sin, the world's sin. But the question that comes into focus for us is not where is God, not how did it happen, but how will it be fixed? When we look at a broken life and we look at a broken world, how, God, will you remedy this broken situation? How are you going to take a broken world and make it new? How are you going to take this world that seems so out of order and fix it? Lots of people have an answer to this question. In fact, I venture to say that everybody has an answer to this question. How would you answer question number three? How will this broken world, how will my broken life be fixed? Some people think the answer comes in a form of government, that if only we had a particular kind of government, then our world would be a better place. It would be good and right and fixed. Some kind of socialist government or a communist government or a democratic government, or I don't know what you're going to label there. I wanted to try and hit everybody so I don't offend anyone. Other people see the answer not in government, but in a grassroots social movement. That if only we can be involved in social justice more and more, then we will fix the world. For other people, it's a humanitarian effort. It's like the movie Pay It Forward, right? If only we do something kind for somebody else, and then they in turn can do something kind for somebody else, then we will fix our world. For other people, it's embodied in a sense of tolerance. If only we tolerate one another and we make sure that every single person's opinion is valid and honored and we tolerate it, then that's how we fix the world. That's how we make it good and right. How would you answer the question? I actually heard an answer to this question in my daughter's Christmas concert on Thursday, of all places. My daughter's in kindergarten and at Dorothea Walker, and they had this great Christmas concert. Well, I have to say great. My daughter was in it. She was the star of the show. No, literally, she was a star. So, no, she wasn't. She was a snowflake, but looked like a star. You've maybe been to one of these things. You know what it's like? You go into one of these packed rooms, and I don't know why they put those seats so close together, right? And they make you sit in one of those seats next to people that you don't know, and you can't really move because you can't go anywhere. You're jammed in like a sardine. And then you have to sit in that seat for about an hour and 45 minutes to hear your daughter on stage for about 2 minutes and 35 seconds. It's painful. I have some pain. Is there anyone that can counsel me in this? Because this was her first year. She's going to be in school for a long time. And at the end of this Christmas concert, it was the crowning moment. It was the very last piece that I heard an answer to this question. The grade 3 class, they got on stage. And the lights went low. And they began to sing. You know what song they sang? It's a good song. I like this song. It's the song Imagine by John Lennon. Right? You probably, I see some people nodding their heads. And when you say the word imagine, we nod our heads a little slower because we're channeling our inner hippie, right? You know? It's like, oh yeah, I know that song. Our voice gets a little lower. And it's like that happened in the auditorium when this song came on. It's as though the whole crowd, they began to resonate with what was being sung. And in many respects, I really love this song because it casts a beautiful vision, although it doesn't quite capture the biblical vision. Some of the lyrics. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people just living for today. Imagine there's no countries, nothing to kill or die for. Imagine all the people living life in peace. Imagine no possessions, no need for greed or hunger. Imagine all the world sharing life in peace. Ooh. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. This is for you, Harvey. You asked if I'd sing today. I hope someday you will join us. Come on, Mission Creek. And the world will live as one. Rolling Stones magazine has written about the message of this song and the impact that it's had on the world. And this is what they said. This was written in 2010 as they reflected on all that this song has meant to our culture. And it describes this song, and the quotes on the screen, as 22 lines of graceful, plain-spoken faith in the power of a world united in purpose to repair and change itself. This is a beautiful song. But listen to what it's saying about how the world will be fixed. That if people come together united in purpose, that through their own effort, they can repair and change the world as we know it. Now, you may say that John Lennon's a dreamer, but he's not the only one. See, there's nothing wrong with this dream. The dream of a world restored, a world where a humanity goes without need, a world where there's no hunger, where there's no greed, where there's no consumerism, where people live at peace and harmony with one another, where there's no war. There is nothing wrong with the dream. But the problem with this song is it offers no power to achieve the dream. That human effort in and of itself has no power to restore and fix a broken person or a broken world. Why? Because humanity is the problem. If history has told us anything, if our journey through the scriptures to this point has told us anything, is that at the very center of the problem of our world is a heart that is prone to wander from God and his ways. And so how on earth can human effort be the solution to the world's problems? And it's not that we're all bad. I mean, our hearts, we want to do good. We want to do well in this world. But really, is it a sustainable solution to the problem if we in and of ourselves are the problem? No. That to fix a broken person and a broken world doesn't come through human effort, but rather it comes from solving the root of the problem, the human person, the human heart. You could say that the prophet Jeremiah, he composes his own song. And I think he gives us more than John Lennon does. In Jeremiah chapter 7, he begins to diagnose the problem. He says in verse 22, "When I brought your ancestors out of Egypt and spoke to them, I gave them this command, 'Obey me, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. Walk in obedience to all I command you, that it may go well with you.' But they did not listen or pay attention. Instead, it says, they followed the stubborn inclinations of their evil hearts." And get this, they went backwards, not forwards. How often do we go backwards in life and not forwards? Because we obey the stubborn inclinations of our hearts. You see, Jeremiah here is acting like a great physician who is coming to diagnose the root problem of a world gone awry. And he says the world isn't the way it's meant to be because people's hearts are stubborn, that they're evil, that they're broken. Do you believe that? I mean, it sounds pessimistic, doesn't it? You see, Israel couldn't live in Jerusalem. They couldn't maintain life in Jerusalem because they had a sickness. They suffered from a chronic heart disease. You see, over and over again in the book of Jeremiah, we see this term coming up, rebellious and stubborn hearts, over and over again. Israel, your rebellious and stubborn hearts. See, Israel was unable to live in Jerusalem, under God's glory, under his promises, marked with his promises, because they suffered from the chronic heart disorder. They constantly rejected him. And here's the thing. Until that problem is solved, the problem of a heart that is prone to say no to God and reject him, to forget his ways and not submit to his leadership, until the problem of the human heart is remedied, there's no hope for Israel, there's no hope for us, and there's no hope for our world. How's your heart these days? Psalm 139 gives us a great spiritual practice. The closing two verses of this great psalm, they say this: "Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me, know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." How's your heart these days? That when you take an honest look at your life, where do you see your stubbornness? Where do you see rebellion? Is it in your greed or anger? In your thoughts, your actions, your attitude? Where is it for you? We all have something. But here's where things get exciting. Just as Jeremiah the prophet, he diagnoses the human problem. He also becomes a herald of its remedy, the solution to humanity's failing. That though it seems we're destined to live in this hopeless cycle repeating itself of rebellion and falling into exile, in Jeremiah chapter 31, Jeremiah becomes a herald of the remedy of all of the world's problems. And in Jeremiah chapter 31, we're given preview into what is called the new covenant. And if you remember last week, I spoke about four special promises that God had given to humanity throughout the Old Testament, through the story of the Old Testament scriptures. Well, here in Jeremiah, we come to the fifth and final promise that is unfolding in the story of the Old Testament, and it's an important one. But let me review the first four. That up to this point in the story, God has been unfolding a plan for the redemption of his people, of the entire cosmos. And we saw that promise first burst onto the scene with Noah, and it's on the screen behind us. That the promise that God had made to Noah was that all creation would be restored. God is on mission to restore all that is broken in the world, to bring life and fullness to all that he has made. But we see that there's a narrowing of this promise. There seems to be a trajectory as to how he wants to fulfill the promise to restore a broken world. And so through Abraham, he says, I will bless all people. And then when he gives the promise at Mount Sinai, the law, he carves out one nation who will carry the promise to the entire world. And then in the promise to David, we saw that that promise, the fulfillment of a restored world, would actually come from one person, a king who would bring a kingdom that would last forever, someone who would usher in a kingdom of God, the world the way it was meant to be. And then in Jeremiah chapter 31, we get the final promise, the final piece of the puzzle of the Old Testament scriptures. Let's read it. Starting in verse 31. The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was husband to them, declares the Lord. But this is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel. After that time, declares the Lord, I will put my law in their minds and I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. God will write his law on our hearts. Here, the covenant, the new covenant, the last promise is about God doing something to our heart. And we get more information on that in Jeremiah's contemporary in the book of Ezekiel in chapter 36. And this is what Ezekiel says about it. I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. You will be my people, and I will be your God. I will save you from all your uncleanness. See, the final piece of God's unfolding story of redemption is that he plans to actually fix the problem that holds people in death and darkness and exile. That he has a plan to restore the whole creation through a nation where one king would come and he would fix the problem of our hearts. That not only would he forgive us, but he would give us a brand new heart, not like the old one. That this is a new day that God is ushering in through this chosen king, the one who will heal and restore and actually enable us to live the life we were made for. Do you ever long for something more? See, when we put the story together, we see God is on a relentless pursuit to restore a broken world. And that through the nation of Israel, one king will come who will establish the kingdom of God, the world the way that it's meant to be. that he will fix everything that's wrong with us and with this world. And it will come through a new covenant. See, we need a new covenant because the old covenant we couldn't live up to. That Israel couldn't be God's people. They were unable to because of their heart condition. Same as us. But the new covenant, God promises to actually do that work for us. To forgive and give us a new heart. That when you look at your life, when you look at this world, do you ever long for something more? Do you long to live in fullness? To live in wholeness? See, we need a king. We need a king to come and be born to earth to forgive us, to free us, to fix us, to restore us, and to bring healing to the nations. And so we sing and we pray, "Come, thou long expected Jesus." Pray with me. I invite you to pray with me. Come, thou long expected Jesus, born to set thy people free. From our fears and sins, release us. Let us find our rest in thee. Israel's strength and consolation, hope of all the earth, thou art. Dear desire of every nation, joy of every longing heart. Born thy people to deliver, born a child and yet a king. Born to reign in us forever, now thy glorious kingdom bring. By thine own eternal spirit, rule in all our hearts alone. By thine own sufficient merit, raise us to thy glorious throne.